It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins. Game over! Franco wins it!
He got it! He pulled it right out of the bushes!
Swing and a miss! He got him! And Aaron Nola leads two.
Swing and a miss! Struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 255. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, a lot to get to on the podcast. Today, we've got some JT Realmuto trade talks. When we last spoke, his name was not being mentioned anywhere near the Phillies, but over the last couple of days, obviously, the Phillies in connection with him. Although we got a little bit of news that kind of throws some cold water on those trade talks, but we'll go over that in just a second. Also, what kind of fit does Bryce Harper have with the Giants? He met with officials from San Francisco this week, apparently, and some big rule changes being mulled over by Major League Baseball and the Players Union that has everybody in baseball talking. Joining me to talk about all of that here on the podcast is my good buddy from The Good Fight, Paul Boyer. You can follow him on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. And Paul, for the most part, pretty much all the time, handles The Good Fight Twitter feed also at The Good Fight. Paul, thanks for coming back on the podcast, pal. How you doing?
John, thanks so much, man. It's good to be back.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the pod, man. You're one of my favorite people. And
aww,
we got a lot. You are. I just got to say it. And we got a lot to get to here, man. We're going to be neck deep in some Phil's chatter and not as much Machado Harper this time around, which
finally,
I think everybody. You know what's been nice about this last 24, 36 hours since the JT Realmuto talk started is that it was something different. You know, it's just, yeah, the Phillies have been loosely connected, and we've had a lot of false starts to Machado and Harper and a lot of other different things here during the course of the offseason.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons why the Macharper stuff is bogging us down so much is that there's nothing left to say,
but
it's still the main topic of conversation. Whereas with this JT Realmuto stuff, it's a different guy to think about. It's a different guy to analyze, a different guy to talk about. He brings a different skill set to a different position. It creates all kinds of things with the Phillies as far as Jorge Alfaro, what prospects would go in a deal. At least it's something a little bit different. And that I welcome that, Paul.
Yeah, no, this is actually a debate worth having, whether this guy is like worth the Phillies going out and acquiring him. Because you look at the two big free agents and you're like, well, yeah, it's a no-brainer. They can help immediately pay him the money. But you'd look at Realmuto and you're like, you actually need to take a step back and think about it. Like, is it worth Alfaro plus? And there's a lot that goes into it. And yes, you're 100% right. It's a welcome distraction.
Well, let's get into this a little bit then, because, again, this kind of came out of nowhere. Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic tweeted out on Tuesday afternoon that the Phillies had recently checked in on Realmuto. The Phils, he said, like many teams, routinely monitor markets for top players and trades and free agency. The continued availability of Realmuto led to renewed communication. No indication a deal is close. And then Tim Brown of Yahoo, who does not often drop bombs into the middle of the tweet deck, came out with a "Keep an eye on the Phillies in JT Realmuto trade possibilities. Sounds as though there could be some traction there." And that, I think, is what got us all interested. You know, when you see Rosenthal say, yeah, the Phillies are checking in, and, you know, when Heyman or Nightingale, you know, fires a tweet out there, we now take it with the skepticism to which they are due. But Tim Brown is kind of a new voice here, and he doesn't normally throw stuff out. So that makes me believe he's got a source. And then it was then backed up by John Heyman, who said the Marlins, like many of the Phillies prospects, they have a young catcher in Jorge Alfaro in the Realmuto talks, but hearing many teams are still in, including the Dodgers, Padres, Reds, Braves, and Rays. So that's what happened on Tuesday, Paul. And on Wednesday, the story was pushed a little bit further. Marlins beat reporter Joe Fusaro told MLB.com, "The Marlins' latest source says Sixto Sanchez is a must in JT trade talk with the Phillies." And so this is where we stand as we record this podcast. On Tuesday, we were kind of excited about the possibility of Realmuto. We're throwing around different ideas, which prospects could work, which some of the young minor major league players on the big league roster could work. And now we're hearing that Sixto Sanchez has to be part of a deal, which in my case makes it a deal breaker, Paul. But what say you about all of this that's gone on in the last 36 hours?
You know, it's funny. Watching this in parallel with the free agency stuff, it seems like this is the Phillies doing to the Marlins with Realmuto what a lot of these other teams are doing to the Phillies with Bryce Harper and Manny Machado, just to bring those names up again, where it looks like there's a value drop. And so the Phillies are like, okay, we have a top half farm system. We have people who could potentially be of interest here. We could potentially use an upgrade at catcher. Let's see what's going on here. I think they're just swooping in. They're thinking, all right, so maybe this reported offer from the Reds of Tucker Barnhart, Jonathan India, and another player, I think was what the proposal was that was floated last week, isn't really moving the needle for the Marlins. So, you know, might as well check in. I do think it's fascinating, right? Because like I was just saying, it is an actual debate. I love Alfaro. I think he's got all the potential in the world, but he's not JT Realmuto right now.
No, he's not.
And what you have to do is you have to figure out what the cost is in the difference between the two of them right now and what you really think the likelihood is of Alfaro reaching his potential. Is it worth Sixto? No, I don't think so. But is it worth a couple other guys? Yeah, potentially to most likely. So it's a balancing act. And I'll be interested to see how real all of this is, because I get a little leery when they say it's a must have. That always kind of comes off to me like a leverage ploy to get some other team to pony up, because then you back yourself into a corner. You know, someone comes out a pretty strong loser in that case. So I don't really think the Phillies are likely here, but it's good that they're at least coming back around and checking in, considering talks really haven't gone anywhere since November.
Yeah. And I wonder too here, there's a couple different angles to take this. One is that I agree with you. I think the Phillies were checking back in because the Marlins realized they weren't going to get as much as they were looking for, and maybe the price had come down. But if they're still asking for Sixto Sanchez, one of two things is possible then. One, the price really hasn't come down, because Sixto Sanchez is, according to just about every prospect ranker, a top 30 prospect in baseball. Yeah. And Baseball America has him at number 19 heading into the season here this year. Or that Sixto Sanchez wasn't even a good enough prospect for Miami the first time around, and now part of their price, quote, coming down is them saying, okay, well, Sixto Sanchez can lead a deal for us. In which case, either case, for me, Sixto shouldn't be a part of this deal, because like you said, I love Alfaro's potential. I think he has the potential to be a top 10 catcher this season if he just cuts down his strikeout rate a little bit and can improve some of the areas in his defensive game, like pass balls and wild pitches and all that stuff. And I think all that's very doable. I think we saw an improvement in Alfaro last year compared to 2017. Mm-hmm. I think he had a better season than most people remember that he had. But that being said, JT Realmuto is probably the best catcher in baseball right now. He hit .277 with a .340 on base percentage and a .484 slugging last year with 21 homers, 74 RBIs. He had a 4.8 FWAR. And what's scary is that he plays in one of the worst hitters parks in the country, playing in Miami. It ranked dead last in terms of home run environment, according to ESPN's Park Factors last year. And we saw what getting out of Miami did for Christian Yelich, moving to a hitter's park like Milwaukee. You look at his home road splits. Realmuto had a home OPS of 773 last year and a weighted runs created of 118. His road OPS was 870, which is about 100 points higher. He hit 13 homers and had a 134 weighted runs created. Over the course of his career, the split in OPS is even more drastic. Home OPS of 676, road of 852.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a big jump. A big jump. And so you're thinking, you get him out of Miami, his offensive numbers are probably even better than what we've seen in Miami. But that being said, Sixto Sanchez is the one blue chip trade piece that the Phillies have.
Yeah.
So the question they have to ask themselves is, I'm not against moving Sixto Sanchez in a deal for a top flight major league player. I'm not against that at all. But you have to ask yourself, is Realmuto the guy to do that for? Because there are other possibilities that could come around this summer. What if Aaron Nola gets hurt this year and you're in the pennant race and you want to maybe get an ace-level type starting pitcher during the trade deadline? You're not going to be able to get that more than likely without Sixto Sanchez. And I'm going to throw the name Mike Trout out there, who I hate people speculating about. But when it comes to Sixto Sanchez, if the Angels ever do decide to make Mike Trout available, you can kiss the Phillies' interest, their chance chances goodbye if they have already dealt Sixto Sanchez.
Oh, man, you're opening up a whole new can of worms with that name drop right
I unloaded some worms.
Oh, yes. Man. But, I mean, bringing things back to 2019 just for a second.
Sure.
No, that's completely accurate. That's the situation right now. Sixto is a guy who is only ranked in the, like, roughly the 20 to 30 range. And you said BA has him number 19 right now.
Yeah.
He's only ranked that low because there's some concern about his size playing into his durability as a major league starting pitcher. He's not the tallest guy. He's about 6 foot. If I remember that right,
it's about right.
Yeah. If I'm mistaking that, sorry. He's not the tallest guy, you know, he's not a mid 6 footer like Roy Halladay or a lanky guy like Chris Sale or anything like that. And he's had a couple of small injury concerns, including losing most of last year, of course, to a couple of injuries. On a stuff level and on an ability level, this is the kind of guy who, you know, everyone whose opinion I trust on this writes about as if he should be a global top 10. Just with those other things concerning his construction that really make him kind of a concern and have, you know, higher volatility. That kind of value is absolutely the kind of thing that can lead a package for an elite player. 100% right. JT Realmuto, you can consider him an elite player. You can. The problem, if you can call it a problem, it's actually kind of a nice problem, is that you already have a catcher on the staff with a lot of potential. He hasn't realized a lot of that potential yet, but it's there. And now you have to talk to yourself and think, okay, how likely do we think it is that this guy is going to make that next step, that's going to keep improving like he did from 2017 into 2018 and turn into the guy that we thought he could be a couple years ago when we got him in the package for Cole Hamels? It's a tough situation, I think, because Realmuto makes you immediately better for this year and next year. But Alfaro is really tantalizing. And is the difference between what you think Alfaro could be, and I know it's a little sketchy, but this is what you're dealing with here. The difference between what you think Alfaro could be and what JT Realmuto will be for the next two seasons. You're not guaranteed anything more after that. So you just, it's a balancing act, and it's so tough. And this is the one move of this offseason, I think, where I'm not really jumping to be in the driver's seat. Because
yeah.
I go back and forth on this almost by the hour as to whether I would like really just load up and say, yeah, let's do it. Let's just go in for the next two seasons, get the guy who's a top two catcher in baseball and improve our lineup just apart from any other addition. And right now, as we sit here recording this, you know, just a little bit after 10 o'clock on the East Coast,
yeah.
I don't know which way I'm leaning. I really don't. And I think a lot of people tell you that's the hallmark of a good trade, right? Or at least getting close to it,
yeah.
Where both sides kind of feel it.
Yeah, no, and I think Phillies fans have to understand that a trade for Realmuto is going to hurt on our end a little bit. And it's probably, if they're not going to deal Sixto Sanchez, I offered this idea yesterday for a trade idea, and I pretty much got it split 50-50 down the middle. People who thought it was too much, people who thought that it wasn't quite enough or that it was just right. And that usually tells me that it's a decent proposal. And
close.
I was thinking, any deal is going to have Alfaro in it. There's just no way around that. And everything you're hearing mentioned from different national reporters is that the Marlins like Nick Williams. So, okay, Nick Williams. We'll put Nick Williams in the deal. I'd say put Adam Haseley in a deal, and then their pick of Adonis Medina or Spencer Howard, who I think both kind of, you know, grade out as low-end number two, number three type starting pitchers at the big league level at some point if things don't fall off a cliff for both of those guys. And so that's a lot. That's a nice package for JT Realmuto.
Yeah.
But the reporting is that they want Sixto Sanchez, which, again, I would not do. But I would do that deal, even though that would hurt the Phillies. I think that's a heavy price to pay, but I think that's a fair price to pay. The only question is whether or not the Marlins actually want to get something done here, because if they're going to stick to their guns about Sixto Sanchez, look, the Phillies know more about Sixto's injury history than anybody,
yeah.
And I'm gonna trust their evaluation on Sixto's elbow and his shoulder. I have no doubt in my mind that with a 19-year-old starting pitcher, they were going out of their way to be overly cautious this last year. That's probably why they shut him down when they did. That's why they didn't let him play in the Arizona Fall League. But the stuff, even when he came back, was all there. There was no drop in velocity, and so there doesn't seem to be any worries about that. The Phillies also know the potential of Jorge Alfaro better than we do. And so while I think Alfaro has the tools and the skills and the potential to be a top 10 catcher in baseball this year, they may not feel the same way. They may be ready to move Alfaro and make that upgrade because it is, like you said, a big upgrade. That's a 2-3 win upgrade more than likely, maybe a 4-win upgrade at the catcher position, which is no small thing.
No.
That's the kind of upgrade we're talking about by adding Bryce Harper or Manny Machado to one of the positions that we're talking about. So, you know, there are some things that the Phillies have information on. And here's one other thing to consider, Paul.
Yep.
Jorge Alfaro and Nick Williams came over as part of the Cole Hamels deal, a deal that was made by Ruben Amaro, not Matt Klentak. Klentak has no emotional attachment to Jorge Alfaro. He has nothing personally invested in seeing that Alfaro succeed in a Philadelphia uniform. So that factors into this a little bit, too.
Yeah, maybe. If we've learned anything from Klentak's tenure here at the helm, it's that we really don't learn much unless they want us to learn things about what goes on.
Yeah.
I get that. And yeah, there's really no legacy attached to this for Klentak, you know, like Amaro's legacy ended on that note of acquiring those players for Hamels, and he ended on a high note, and that was great. But again, like you say, he's not around here anymore. It's so tough, and I can feel the inner conflict in me right now as we're even talking about this. Like, I've gone back and forth twice just even since we started talking about this. because I'm a huge Alfaro fan, and I think we've talked about him on a couple of these episodes here, and I've tried to really make the case that, yeah, he's got his flaws, but man, this guy's really got some potential. And then I look across the river and I see, oh, yeah, there's one of the consensus best catchers in baseball who has 20 homer pop, can steal bases, has a good arm, and is a good defensive catcher all at once, and you get him for 2 years. And I start to sweat a little bit. So it's like, I have a feeling I'm going to be struggling with this for a while. I am going to be completely fine if they don't trade for Real Muto because I like Alfaro so much. But I'll also get it and probably be on board if they do swap. Like, you know what I mean? You know, like, I'm okay both ways. I'm just a little nervous about what it might take to actually fully offset the value and make it a fair trade. I don't know.
At the end of the day, what odds do you give this of actually happening? Because I felt much better about it on Tuesday, and with the Sanchez news, I don't think the Phillies will include him as a part of this deal. Do you think that there's a chance the Phillies could put Sixto Sanchez in a deal for this, for Real Muto?
No, I don't. I don't think this is the deal they do that. I think it's right of the Marlins to keep trying and salvage as much value as they can, because Real Muto.
And maybe it's just an opening offer.
Maybe.
You know what I mean? That could be it too. Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's it. I mean, Real Muto right now is the guy that has the most trade value currently on, you know, that Marlins roster. They want to get it right, and I get that. This reads to me more of a, hey, other teams pony up a little bit more, you know, we're interested, but put a little bit more on the table, than it does seriousness about the Marlins engaging with the Phillies. I get that there's probably some, you know, like for like going on there, maybe with Alfaro, maybe with Williams. I'd put the Phillies' chances somewhere around 10%. I think they're back in the pack right now.
I'd put it a little higher. I'd say 20%, if only because I don't think the Phillies would get re-engaged here. And I think if they're getting re-engaged here, they have a genuine interest in Real Muto, and they think there's a reasonable possibility they could swing a deal with Miami, because they had to know early in the offseason when Real Muto was first put on the market and the Phillies had some interest and had some conversations. They had to know what the asking price was then. And I don't think that they would be either wittingly or unwittingly doing, they have to know that if they would imagine they would know if they were being used to kind of drum up the price from another team. And the Phillies don't want the Marlins to get better prospects. There's no way they want that to happen. So I don't think they would get re-engaged here and play this game unless they themselves really did have interest and really did think that there was a possibility something could get worked out, because it's not in the Phillies' interest to help out the Marlins here in any way, shape, or form. I will say, too, that I don't believe that teams should be afraid to trade within the division because if that team is giving you the best offer, the best deal, you take it. Doesn't matter whether it's a team you play in your division 19 times a year or if it's in the NFL twice a year or whatever. That being said, if you're going to trade within your division, it probably should be by far the best deal you're getting offered from anybody else.
Yeah, yeah, that jives. I think that's 100% right. And we've seen it a lot more over the last few years. I think teams are a little less reluctant to deal players within the division. And it's for the betterment of the sport, honestly, because if you're closing yourself off to four trade partners who are willing to be, you know, active and deal with you, yeah, even though there's a little bit of a emotional baggage attachment to this whole thing, you really can't close yourself off to that. You really can't. Like you said, if the best deal is coming from right next door, even if you're going to see the person, you know, when you walk outside and go to your car to go to work, so be it. You know, if it's for the best for both of you, it's something you have to entertain.
One last thing on this, and then we'll move on. I've had some people ask me what they think, what we think this means for getting Harper or Machado. Does this affect their hunt for one of those two guys? Are they going after Realmuto because they're suddenly more pessimistic of their chances of getting Harper and Machado? The good thing here is that I think Realmuto's salary this year is something under $6 million. I think it's in the fives or something like that. So the payroll, the money has absolutely no bearing on Harper or Machado. And I don't really think, I think this is completely separate from that pursuit, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that too. Do you think that there is any connection here between the Phillies' pursuit of Mitch Harper and them trading for JT Realmuto, other than just adding another good player to a team as a way to maybe entice one of those guys to sign on the dotted line?
Yeah, I think that's more what it is. You know, it couldn't hurt to add a really good player if you're still courting these guys as free agents. You know, it's funny because reviewing every single move this offseason through this prism, will it affect their decisions? Will it not? Like what is it going to do to their perception of this team if we bring in this, that, or the other guy? And that's great. But of course, viewing things through that lens, you immediately jump in and say, oh, okay, Bryce Harper once spoke fondly of JT Realmuto. Maybe they want to play on the same team together. You start reaching for things.
Yeah.
We wouldn't do that.
We don't do that. Come on.
No, never. I think, like you mentioned, the money part of it, not that the Phillies have money problems anyway, but yeah, the money has absolutely no effect. And then, yeah, I don't see it as anything more than potentially adding a guy who would be a really good baseball player at a team that neither of the two big free agents remaining play. You know, he would be a supplement.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. I mean, just make the team more attractive. I mean, I think that's the only effect that it would have on the Mitch Harper sweepstakes. And coming up, we're going to get into just a little bit more about Bryce Harper. He met with the San Francisco Giants this week, apparently, just a few days after meeting with the San Diego Padres. We'll talk to you a little bit about the fit there, the potential there. And, you know, John Middleton said he was going to spend stupid money. We haven't seen that yet. What's that all about? We'll tackle all that coming up next right here on Hittin' Season. And welcome back to Hittin' Season. John Stolness along with Paul Boyer here talking Phillies hot stove. And Paul, earlier this week, Bryce Harper met with the San Francisco Giants. And while I don't think that this is a big threat to the Phillies right now, I do think that this has a little tiny bit more fire than his meeting with the San Diego Padres, if only because the Giants are a team that actually likes to spend money. Now, that being said, there are some very clear reasons why a Bryce Harper to San Francisco Giants situation doesn't quite make sense in my mind. But let me get your sense of it first. What do you make of Bryce Harper meeting with the Giants? Is this just a ploy by Scott Boras, or do you think there's some real mutual interest here?
I think it's more plausible than we might want to admit. as competitors here, because yeah, there's payroll space. They're somewhere around 30, 35 under luxury tax cap right now, if that's playing into it, and they absolutely have a need. Oh my goodness, have you looked at their outfield depth chart lately? Because it is not overwhelming.
No.
their current starting outfield as roster resource has it right now. In left field, you have Chris Shaw. In center field, you have Steven Duggar. And in right field, you have Mac Williamson. Now,
you made those names up.
Right. You know, hey, do you know? Like, yeah. You look at that and you're like, wow, okay. The outfield situation there could use a bit of an upgrade, probably. And the Giants were content to not really be players on Michael Brantley. They don't really seem to like the idea of Adam Jones, when I guess they could just play one of those other guys and see if they improve. And they didn't really like AJ Pollock. Apparently, we didn't really hear any strong connections with the second tier of these outfielders. So to hear them meeting with Bryce Harper, you're like, well, where'd that come from? That's kind of weird. The more you look at it, though, the more it starts to make sense. This is a guy who can play any outfield position. Yes, I know one of the things that's talked about a lot is how badly his defensive numbers slid last year and going out to San Francisco, where center field and right field are an absolute nightmare to learn.
Yeah.
Doesn't really make a ton of sense on its face. I think those numbers belie Harper's ability. You know, a bad defensive season does not a bad defensive player make.
Yeah, he pulled back last year, too. I mean, he was worried about getting hurt ahead of his free agent, because he's been injured playing the outfield recklessly from time to time. So that's where that came from.
Yeah, I'll always remember him running into the wall at Dodger Stadium, like busting open his neck or something. Like, that was just, ooh, man.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the Giants have a need. They have payroll space. They've obviously spent a lot of money in the recent past. And they still right now have a team and a lineup that could push for some kind of contention. They're by no means a title contender right now, as I look at them. But they didn't trade Madison Bumgarner, right? Buster Posey is still pretty good. He's hanging in there. Joe Panik, I think Joe Panik is a pretty pivotal player for the Giants this year. Getting him back to form would really go a long way to helping them. But if you add a guy like Bryce Harper and you supplement that lineup, the Giants have always somehow pulled good pitching out of the woodwork. Right, just look at Derek Rodriguez last year.
Yeah.
They find a way to make pitching staffs work. If you can add a little bit of oomph to that offense, and they really could, you know, I'm not going to count them out. I'm not going to wave my hand at the Giants right now. I think it makes plenty of sense, and I think they should be looked at as a serious competitor. Absolutely.
I see it making sense from the Giants' perspective, very much so, for all the reasons that you just mentioned. And one of the reasons that pitching, they always seem to find it in San Francisco, is because they do play in an extreme pitcher's park. Formerly AT&T Park, now Oracle Park, ranked 29th out of 30 teams in terms of home run environment for hitters in 2018. And that's not a one-year blip. They're generally speaking last in the league in home run environment for hitters. Last year, it was the third worst home run park for left-handed hitters. So if you're Bryce Harper, your offensive numbers are likely to go down in San Francisco. Now, if you get a $350 million deal, I know the argument there is, do you really care what your offensive numbers look? Yes, you do. Mm. You know, Bryce Harper wants to get into the Hall of Fame. He wants to win titles. He wants to be an all-star. He doesn't want to be a guy who's hitting 20 to 25 home runs. And, you know, yeah, he's hitting like 290, but his slugging percentage is 450. He doesn't want to be that guy. He wants to be a guy who hits 40, 45 homers a year. You know, and that's just not going to happen in San Francisco. Only Barry Bonds was capable of doing all of that. And so I think San Francisco has some nice pieces. It definitely makes sense if you're the Giants to at least have a conversation. Certainly makes sense if you're Bryce Harper to have a conversation, because clearly they have not gotten the offers that they're looking for yet. And I don't necessarily think this is the Giants looking for a dumpster dive here. Although, do I believe they're ready to go 10 years, $350 million on Bryce Harper? I don't think that they are, but who knows? You know, I mean, they got a new GM, and, you know, who knows exactly what he's thinking right now? Because if I were him, I would have started the rebuild train this offseason. I would have moved Madison Bumgarner. I would have, you know, and Madison Bumgarner is going to be a free agent after this year. Is Bryce Harper going someplace that doesn't have a clear ace starter after this season? You know, it's just the San Francisco Giants are on the descent, and I don't see him signing with a team that clearly has age issues. They have a weak farm system. It doesn't look like they're going to be a true title contender for a while, but it is interesting. It is interesting because San Francisco does usually find a way to they didn't last year, but San Francisco, generally speaking, is not an also-ran in Major League Baseball, Paul.
No, I'd agree with that. And that's a good converse view of things, right? Like this, this year and maybe next year feels like San Fran's last shot at this window that they have with Posey and Bumgarner. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe they'll pluck a diamond in the rough out of that system and, you know, open that window for a little bit longer.
And maybe they want to, maybe they want to do a 2-year deal that pays them $40 million a year. You know what I mean?
You know, it, the longer this goes on, the more fascinating it gets to see what this contract eventually looks like, right? Like, we already knew it was going to be complicated. We already knew there were going to be bells and whistles, an opt out or two or three. We knew there were going to be probably escalators and other options involved at the end. And all of these other things were going to go into it. That was always going to make these negotiations complicated. But now that we've gotten to February and we've still got all these teams checking in like, hey, well, what do you think about this? I have no idea what this is going to look like anymore. I don't know how long it's going to be. I don't know how many opt-outs are going to be in there. I don't know what the average annual value is going to look like. I don't know a thing. And I am going to give up pretending I have any kind of understanding of what it might look like. I have no idea. So if he's open to a 2 or 3 year deal at some crazy number and a team wants to offer him that and he's like, ah, hell with it. Sure. I'll try this again in 3 years. Who am I to say no? Right.
At right. This point. Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's the argument is a lot of people have been making, you know, hey, you can be the highest paid player on AAV for a couple of 3 years, couple of years, whatever it happens to be. And maybe that's enough for them to, you know, one of these guys or Harper in this case that we're talking about to pull the trigger. You know, one of the things that we're seeing here, you know, we talk about Matt Klintak a lot in having to be involved in these negotiations. And it sure seems as though during this process that the Phillies front office, the decision makers, Matt Klintak, Andy McPhail, are the ones who are still kind of calling the shots, because one would imagine that the Phillies have not made the Godfather offer yet. You know, they haven't made the offer that Harper and Machado can't refuse. They're looking at the landscape, seeing the few suitors that are out there, and feel that their offer is probably still the best one, and it very well might be. But we heard John Middleton talking about spending stupid money this offseason, and that hasn't happened yet. There has been no spending of stupid money. Ethan Whitty wrote a good piece for The Good Fight about it today. It's up at thegoodfight.com, so make sure you check it out. But John Middleton is really, I think, driving this train now, Paul. This is kind of his baby with these two free agents. He's the one who can push this thing and say, let's get this done. I don't care if we, you know, are outbidding everybody by $50 million. I want this done now. I want this guy in spring training now. But it sounds as though that he is listening to his front office people. And that may usually speak. We want the owners to do that. We want the owners to take a hands-off approach to things. It's just interesting. I think with these two guys, with the kind of money we're talking about, that it's the John Middleton show now. This is kind of beyond that, because, you know, your general manager is supposed to go out there and identify fits and look at the guys from a baseball perspective and say, this guy would work for us. This guy does this well. You know that Bryce Harper and Manny Machado are fits. It's all about the money. It's all about the contract. And that's John Middleton.
Yeah. And I am really fascinated to learn, hopefully sooner than this, maybe like 5-6 years from now, when some writer is able to get Matt Klintak and maybe Scott Boras into a room or separate or something like that, and get an oral history of everything that's gone on with these negotiations. The Phillies, like we were saying, are notoriously tight-lipped, and they probably wouldn't want to give away any of their secrets.
It'd be a great book, though.
Oh, my goodness. Look, I'll tell you, there has to be so much going on behind the scenes right now, and it's just killing me that we don't get any insight into this. You have Middleton come out at the start of the offseason and be like, he drops that S word, and that's all anybody has latched onto for the last 3 months. But you wonder at some point if somebody got his ear and was like, hey, look, we're going to try and get this price down. We're going to work it. We are going to stretch this out and play the patient game, not necessarily come in with guns blazing and give that Godfather offer right off the bat. That requires, I like to think of myself as more patient than I used to be, but that still requires 5 times the patience than I would ever have. And Middleton is either agreeable to that, or he himself has come down from his words. we don't know. And I think it would be so fascinating to hear from these people to understand what their thought processes were like as the winter has drawn on. Because you, as an owner, and Middleton wanted to be more front and center a couple of years ago, and he's done a good job of being accountable, being upfront, being visible, at least as far as my perception is. Mm-hmm. And he comes right out there and he's like, yeah, look, this offseason that you all have been looking forward to for a while, we're going to be active. We're going to do something about it. And everybody's like, ooh, okay. And rubbing their hands together. And now here we are 3 months later. There have been a couple of good additions. I like Andrew McCutchen. I really like David Robertson. I think the Segura trade was good, even though that was a trade, not a signing. But that's not what you attach the S word to.
Yeah.
And I wonder who's gotten his ear. I wonder what changed his mind. Because if he was, I think, and again, we don't know, so all this is guesswork, but I think if he was really eager to go with all of this still and really like gung-ho about it, that something would have happened. And we wouldn't be at this point where the offer's unsatisfactory and teams like the Padres and Giants are flying out to check in and say, hey, what's the deal? So something is weird. Something is weird about this whole thing, because this is not a stupid money approach to have it go this mm-hmm. long. So I don't know what it is. Something is weird and something changed. And I would love to know what that is.
What I would love to know, as much as what you just described, is what was John Middleton thinking when he made the, we might spend money and we might spend it in a stupid way? He didn't say we were going to spend stupid money. And with that, it's right. just been shortened to that right. for the sake of convenience. But, you know, I'm not, when I say I wonder what he was thinking, like he's crazy to say that, I'm wondering, no, what was actually in his mind? What was he envisioning in his head? What was the scenario that he was thinking of when he uttered that phrase? Because at the time I took it to mean they're going to try and get both. Mm-hmm. Or it meant they're going to sign a ton of guys. You know, they're going to go after help in the starting rotation. They're going to go get a couple of big bats. They're going to go do this. They're going to go do that. Or, you know, they're going to, you know, they're just going to litter the landscape with offers and with big money deals. And, you know, they're going to go over the luxury tax. You know, they're not yeah. even going to care about the luxury tax. That was the, and everything we've seen is not that.
Right.
You know, they overpaid probably Andrew McCutchen by about $10 million bucks. Okay, that's not stupid money. That's just, you know, they wanted Andrew McCutchen. They really liked Andrew McCutchen, so they gave him extra, you know, probably a little bit more than they needed to when we're looking at some of the other deals that other outfielders have gotten here so far in the offseason. But it wasn't crazy. They didn't go crazy with David Robertson. As a matter of fact, they settled, I don't know if they settled on David Robertson, but they passed up some other guys on some bigger deals because they liked the certainty of David Robertson. You know, so here we are, you know, as we're getting ready to get into spring training and they've added two free agents and made a trade, they've done well. Like you said, they've improved. But I don't believe that's what was in John Middleton's head when he uttered that phrase. And no. I just wonder what it was. I wish I could hook him up to a lie detector tester or get some, you know, get some truth serum inside of him and ask him that question. What were you thinking when you said that?
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever know. I hate to keep saying that just because I'm...
He's not going to let me drug him. He's just not going to let me do it. No matter how nicely I ask, no matter who I go through in the Phillies organization, he's not going to let me drug him. It's just wrong.
It's just such a bummer, isn't it?
It is, no. man. Gosh.
But I would love to know so much more than what I think we will ever know about what happened in the winter of 2018 to 19. And that's a shame. We might have to wait a really long time for people to open up about this. But boy, I'm sure there are stories to be told about this, man. Ooh, boy.
Yeah, and the beat writers, I think, are just as in the dark as we are, having just talked to a couple of them, you know, in DMs on Twitter and stuff like that. They are as frustrated as anybody else because the Phillies are locked up like Fort Knox. And so if somebody does write a book about this, they either have the information and they're Fort Knox too, or it's going to have to all be done post after the fact, you know, in post-production here. So maybe somebody will get a book out on this, because this has been a fascinating offseason for the Phillies. Coming up, we're going to get into some of these rule changes that has everybody yelling at each other on Twitter, specifically the designated hitter to the National League. You all know my stance on that. We'll get Paul's take on that and some of the other rules that have been the new rules changes that have been floated by both the league and the union. We'll do that coming up right here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So the Major League Baseball Players Union and Major League Baseball themselves have offered dueling proposals that could take effect as early as this year, Paul, which is too early for me. I mean, especially with instituting, one of them was the designated hitter to the National League, which is something that I have wanted going back to 2014. Yeah. I've tweeted it out a couple of times over the last 24 hours, a piece that I wrote back even way back then after an infuriating Kyle Kendrick quote after a particularly frustrating at-bat that he had in a meaningless game in the middle of 2014 that finally sent me over the edge and got me to thinking, I just don't want pitchers in baseball hitting anymore. I don't want it anymore. I'm all done with it. And that put me over the edge, and I've been pro DH to the National League, and so I've gotten into a lot of conversations on Twitter about that today. I got into a back and forth on Twitter with Mitch Williams for about 15 or 20 minutes before he realized he was arguing with a blogger and decided to stop. So I think that was probably a smart move for Mitch Williams Day. there's also a couple other rules on here, Paul. A possible three-batter minimum for pitchers. This was floated by the league, which would essentially eliminate the one-batter reliever, the loogies, the left-handed specialists that we've been talking about. A single trade deadline before the All-Star break. So instead of having a waiver trade deadline and a non-waiver trade deadline, there would just be a trade deadline, and it would happen before the All-Star break. A 20-second pitch clock, which is going to happen this year. I'm almost positive that's going to happen. An expansion of rosters to 26 with a 12-pitcher max, but you would also then reduce the 40-man rosters in September down to, I think it was 29, if I saw it correctly. There would be draft advantages for teams that win a certain number of games and draft penalties for tanking teams, teams that just lose too many games. And there would also be a study to lower the mound and a rule that would allow two-sport amateurs to sign major league deals right away. That would be the Kyler Murray rule. So, Paul, there's a lot there. There's a lot of different rules. Everybody's focusing on the DH to the National League, and I guess we can probably start there since that is what everybody's talking about. What's your thoughts on the DH to the National League? It's okay if you hate it because you're not alone. I've been getting yelled at all day.
Yeah, I mean, as it relates specifically to the DH thing, I'm pretty neutral about the whole thing. I used to be resistant to the idea of having the leagues be homogenized. There is admittedly something a little bit romantic about the two leagues being separate. Even before getting into, you know, the whole talk about strategy and National League managing, double switching.
Can I interrupt you for a second, Paul?
Yeah.
I want to address that.
Okay.
The whole leagues being separate, because I used to love that because it made the All-Star game special. Mm. It made the World Series special. But since the introduction of interleague play, that's out the window.
Mm.
So that part of it for me, the leagues no longer are separate. They all share umpires now. You know, there's no American League and National League umpires. They're all one group of umpires. You know, nobody knows who the National League president is anymore, or the American League president. You used to know who those guys were back before interleague play, because there was a delineation between National League and American League. And for me, that's when the rule made sense. DH in the American League made sense. And the National League having no DH, It made a lot more sense to me when the leagues were basically like two totally separate entities. And with interleague play and all the other stuff, to me that doesn't hold true anymore, which is another reason why I just think the DH is kind of a relic. But anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to throw that in.
No, and I think that's a good point. And that's probably that realization, I think, has been the thing that's evolved in me the most over time, right? I look at the difference between the leagues and how it's shrinking and think, like, what would we really be missing if we removed pitchers batting and we removed the strategic part of the equation that involves pitcher use and bench use when the pitcher spot came up later in games? And I think that something would be lost, I'll admit, There is something to be said about having your bench bats and your relief arms ready when they need to be in those situations. I think there is a skill to that, and I think that actually does take managerial know-how. That being said, removing pitchers from the batting order and their, what, like sub 300 OPS or something like that from later, like 350 OPS, like just something putrid. Removing that from the equation, I think, would do more to the entertainment value of the game. This is where I am. This is the headspace I'm in right now. Would do more for the entertainment value of the game, potentially even add offense. Well, but almost certainly would add offense. And that would do more positive than removing that strategic aspect would harm things or would impact, would add negative impact. There's more to it than that. Obviously, every change that goes into this game isn't quite that simple. But I find myself thinking more and more that adding a true hitter and potentially stretching out pitcher appearances, which I think would work in conjunction with this three batter minimum thing pretty nicely, would actually, it's a good start, right? I think a lot of these rules that you were talking about are a good start in that vein. I think moving the mound back was one thing that was floated. I think that's insane.
I wouldn't do that.
No, that's ludicrous. Lowering it, I could get behind that if there's some evidence saying that, you know, lowering it such and such amount of inches would have this impact, and it was mostly negligible except for potentially adding contact. Whatever, I'm open to it. I'm willing to listen, and that's the case with most of these things. I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to consider the universal DH. I'm willing to consider the pitch, and the pitch clocks are probably fine. I'm willing to consider the three batter minimum. A lot of these things, I think, at the very least, are going to need to be discussed if we're going to avoid a lockout in a couple of years.
Absolutely.
Like that's the big goal here. There are some changes that the league is floating that I think are a little bit short-sighted and won't necessarily do more good than bad. But that's for another time. I want to see progress toward avoiding a lockout. Obviously, the things that were floated now are not going to be finalized. These aren't things that we're going to see immediately, and they're not going to be implemented in the form in which they're being reported because it's mostly incomplete. We don't know all the details. But I think the fact that these things are being exchanged is a positive. And most of the things that are being exchanged and reported aren't insane. The most insane thing is pushing the mound back, I think, honestly.
Yeah. No, yeah, you're right. That's crazy. I mean, you'd have to, that would require a whole mess of stuff to have to go down. But everything you hear is that nobody notices the 20-second pitch clock in the minors. I think that's a change that nobody is going to mind. I think pitchers will be happy with it because it'll force batters to stay in the batter's box and they won't get as frustrated about guys like Odubel Herrera taking 20 minutes to get himself together, which can be infuriating if you're a pitcher. And you know, the three batter minimum on for pitchers is not my favorite idea in the world. I don't really find that having the loogie every now and then is a big deal, moving a guy after one batter, as long as it doesn't happen like 2-3 innings in a row. When you've got like managers coming out and taking out a pitcher after one hitter 5 times in a row, that gets to be a bit much. But I think a three batter minimum at the bottom line is, with all of this different stuff, as you mentioned, at least they're trading ideas. You know, it sounds like that there's a dialogue now, finally, for the first time between the league and the players union. They recognize that, you know, a strike is certainly possible in a couple of years, and they don't want it to get to that point. I think a DH to the National League is a fait accompli at this point. It's going to happen at some point. There's no way around it. You're hearing now that Rob Manfred and the owners even kind of want it. You know, so I think there's absolutely no way the DH is not coming to the National League, and it will probably be here by 2020. I don't think it'll be here in 2019. I think it would be way too soon to implement it by then. Teams have not constructed all their rosters because there's still a lot of guys out there who could be potential designated hitters. And maybe that's when we'll see if they actually do go ahead and institute that policy. Maybe we see a run on guys here over the last couple of weeks of February and early March. But I think here what we've got is a situation where the two leagues, the two sides are finally talking to each other, trading ideas. Of course, the main sticking point to avoiding a strike is talking about the financial compensation, yeah. the years of team control, free agency, all that kind of stuff, minor league pay. I think all those are the things that are really going to be the sticking points. But at least if they can get to some kind of an agreement on these different things to improve pace of play, to increase offense, to reduce the number of relief pitchers, to strengthen the role of the starting pitcher in Major League Baseball. Once again, all things that I think you and I are both in favor of, and many, many baseball fans are in favor of. That's all for the good. And, you know, for me, I think the designated hitter in the National League, I just keep coming back to when I'm watching the Phillies play an interleague game and it gets to be the third inning, and I know that the Phillies have gone 1-2-3 in the first two innings. Sometimes when I'm watching a Phillies game, I'm like, I don't really need to pay attention here in the third because it's the 7-8-9 hitters. That's not what you should have to do with a baseball game. You know, you shouldn't be able to, like, take a whole half inning off because you're reasonably sure this section of the lineup isn't going to do anything. When I'm watching an interleague game, it dawned on me in 2014 when I wrote that piece, like, you know something? When I'm watching an interleague game, I'm actually really relieved that the DH is here, you know, that I'm not going to have to watch the pitcher hit. And that's when it occurred to me, I really hate this. It's the strategy, quote unquote, the strategy doesn't matter to me as much as the annoyance of watching rallies die and watching players who don't consider themselves to be hitters try and do this job. It'd be like asking your running back to play quarterback every once in a while. You know, that's the, you know, it's like, okay, let's have let's mandate that every nine plays, the running back has to throw a pass. You know, that's not what the running back does. Being a quarterback is a very specific and special skill that requires all of that player's attention. Same as being a pitcher. That's why they're not good hitters. There are some, the outliers, and people like to use the outliers as reasons for keeping things the way they are. But I don't think you can use, for me, I don't like using the outlier as a reason to not do things. I do get, Paul, that people don't want the strategy to go away, that there is some strategy involved, but, you know, really how often, how many times a season, I need to do the research on this, because I don't think I saw a double switch in a Phillies game more than 9 or 10 times last year. It doesn't happen nearly as often as fans think.
No, it doesn't happen that often, and I think that's what, with this rule in particular, we need to try and think about. And one of the reasons why I've become a little bit more amenable to at least the idea being floated is that what are we really losing? What's being given up? When it comes to this rule, when it comes to pitcher usage, honestly, there are other things that need to be addressed, mostly with regard to service time, minor league wages. Those are far more important. And those are things that have not come up in any of these reports right now. Like those are the big issues that need to be tackled. Yeah. And we haven't quite gotten to those yet. Yeah. So some other work needs to be done. But honestly, one of the worst things that could come from this is affecting the way the game is played at the lower levels all the way on up to the major league level. You know, things from moving the mound back, that completely changes a pitcher's approach, probably their mechanics and how hard they have to throw the ball. There was one part of the pitcher usage rule on the converse of the minimum where you need to have a starting pitcher throw at least 4 innings or maybe 5. I think Bill James floated that idea or something like that.
Yeah.
That's overexertion a lot of times, especially with the number of strikeouts and foul balls. Like that's bad. You don't want to risk injury. You don't want to change the way the players play the game in that way. So there are ways this can go wrong. But like you said, I'm going into this with an open mind, because what's most important to me is putting a little bit of implicit trust in the players' union to get their act together and understand what's important and come to the table with, you know, strong suggestions and hold their ground when countered. But at the end of the day, I want to make sure this sport continues, because a lockout would hurt a lot of people and would hurt a lot of fandoms. We don't want to see what happened in 1994 and 95 happen again. This is not the way to celebrate a 25th anniversary. So there's a lot of work to be done. It is a very, very complicated issue. But I think that this was a good first step, that there's dialogue going on, that most of the ideas being floated are not totally insane, and that hopefully there's progress to be made. That's all I can really hope for at this point.
At the end of the day, do you think we see the DH in the National League this season?
No, I think they're going to stop short of the unilateral changes. I don't think we're going to see Manfred throw the pitch clock in right now. I don't think he's going to immediately say, yeah, you have to do the base runner on second base in extra innings. Like I think that's more of a threat than anything else. I don't think that's actually going to happen. But I do agree with you that we're probably looking at inevitability at this point. It would just be a matter of 2020 or potentially with the next CBA.
Well, Paul, I think, you know, we've gotten some nice, some fun things to talk about non-Machado Harper related this week. And we'll see over these next couple of days whether or not the Phillies and the Marlins have anything going here on JT Realmuto. We'll see if Bryce Harper meets with any other also ran organizations here over the next. I mean, why not a Seattle Mariners visit here?
Yeah, sure. Bryce?
Why the hell not? You know, why, go on up to the Great Northwest and meet with some other folks while you're up there. Again, folks, follow Paul Boyer on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. You can also read his stuff on Twitter at The Good Fight. He handles our Twitter feed at The Good Fight, and of course, Paul does fantastic writing for us at The Good Fight, and he's one of my favorite podcast guests in the world. Paul Boyer, thank you so much for coming back on Hit and Season, pal.
John, my man, always a pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Go to the Good Fight podcast feed, mash the subscribe button with your thumb, leave a rating and a review while you're there. And if you would do me a favor, if you have friends or family members who like Phillies baseball, who like podcasts, but somehow don't know about this podcast, subscribe for them. Grab their phones and subscribe to the podcast for them. Tell them about the show and tell them to give us a rating and a review as well. 5-star ratings help Phillies fans in the great worldwide web find us just that much faster, and that you'll get Hit and Season and continued success with Justin and Liz, and of course a brand new Dirty Inning with Justin and Trevor Strunk, where they took a look back at a Bruce Ruffin game from 1989. Baby, that's my wheelhouse, late 80s Phillies baseball, man. If you're somebody in their 30s or 40s, that is just manna from heaven for you. So make sure you're subscribing to the Good Fight podcast feed so you can get all of that good stuff. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you all next time right here on Hit Season.